So last month we took a little, you know, sort of examined our life last month. Now this month there may be new things that we feel we'd like to work on or examine. But since this has to do with kind of inner culture and the art of personality and the development of our character, again, we may want to reflect on what it was last month that we thought was significant, and it may be a continuation this month, or there may be something new that we feel we'd like to look at and reflect upon in our being that we would like to refine in our manner, our thought, our speech, our actions. And again, the teaching for this month is titled The Development of Personality, the Jarring Effect of the Ego of Another. I think it's also very important to think that in relationship to I am the other in relationship to Joe or Cabrilla or, you know, whoever. So we have to look at it that way. We turn the mirror on ourselves as well. So the words of Hazaradanai Khan. By a keen outlook on life, we find that what disturbs us most in life is the ego of another person. It is the ego that has a jarring effect upon life. Those who know the right manner of developing personality know that the first lesson in life is to efface that ego as much as possible. Christ says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit." That poorness in spirit is the softening of the ego. I feel I want to stop here, and I want to make it, it's such a subtle thing, like how do we define that ego? And back on the subject, Nori called me about self-denial. It doesn't necessarily mean, I gave the example of fasting, but in truth, it's the denying of that self, that small self. Do you understand? I mean, if we can get to a place, God willing, if we could, of selflessness, then we would not see this separation of the world. And that's what the Sufi path is. We're seeking union. It's not something that's very common, and it's maybe something we touch in moments of our meditation or our practice together in zikr. You know, we maybe have moments of that where we understand it. But it's a bit touchy because according to some clinical psychologists, if you totally efface that and you merge with other, there are terms for that, psychological terms. So it's a bit of a slippery slope, and Murshid Samuel Lewis used to call it controlled schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. You know, being open to that world and being in this world simultaneously. That does take a great deal of mastery. To see everything and often not speak of it. To know everything, to feel everything. The Taoists teach about this idea of timing. That's the correct timing for everything too. Christ says, "Blessed are the poor of spirit." That poorness in spirit is the softening of the ego. When the ego is softened in a person, then in the thought, speech, and action of that person, there is a charm. Sometimes a person, after going through disillusionment, suffering, torture, shows in his personality some charm. And that charm has come from the softening of the ego. You know, anyone that knows the story of Gandhi, Mahatma Gandhi knows what he went through. You remember in South Africa, he was picking up those documents that they were required to carry for identity, and he was burning them, and they kept beating him, and he just kept picking them up. Sri Aurobindo, who's a great yogi of integral yoga system, his yoga is beautiful because it doesn't just teach you to go like this. He teaches you how to come down. It's a great path of mastery. But he spent his years during the revolution. He was Oxford educated. He wrote and he spoke out against the British. And as a result, he was imprisoned in the worst prison where people were the most mistreated. It was like a death sentence to be sent there. And you know what he did? He thought to himself, this is my meditation cell. And he meditated in those terrible conditions and gained his enlightenment. Everything's part of the path. Everything. So even torture, they're saying here. But I'm going to go back one sentence. Sometimes a person, after going through disillusionment, suffering, torture, shows in his personality some charm. And that charm has come from softening of the ego. But any virtue that develops naturally, forced by life or circumstance, is not a virtue in the same sense as that which is developed through one's own effort. So while we can use these circumstances, it's our own self-examination and effort that are really of such benefit. Every beautiful action, thought, or speech is derived from the effacing of self or ego. For instance, every manner of courtesy comes from holding the reins of the ego. So, small example of chivalry. You know, instead of like being the first in the door, being courteous and holding the door open. You know, Murshid Hidayat likes to tell this story of his father. He was a young boy and accompanying his father through the gates of Fazl Manzil in France. And there are, in fact, pictures of this too, of the workmen. There was, on the boulevard there, they were sort of laying the street even, because this was an area outside of Paris that was more rural, and they were putting the streets in. And it was raining. And there was a man that was digging in a ditch and was just covered with mud. I've told this story. Some of you know this story. And he said he remembers, he was holding his father's hand and they were walking out. And Murshid went up to the man and took off his hat and bowed and extended his hand to wish him a good day. And the man was so startled, you know, because he was just covered in mud, and here's this very dignified person comes out and greets him in this way. And, you know, the man was so touched with the manner of dignity of this dignified being treating a ditch digger in such a dignified way. This is the matter, this courtesy, this sort of, I'm not so proud I live in this house and I have all these, you know, he felt that humanity. And, Murshid Hidayat said years later, years later, he was there. You know, that was the family home. And after Murshid had passed, there was a man that was standing outside the gates, and he was looking at the house. And Murshid Hidayat went out, and he said, "Can I help you?" And he said, "Oh, I'm wondering, does the king that lived in that house still there?" Mm-hmm. It was years later, I mean, you know, years later the man had aged, but that had made such an impression on him, that moment of courtesy, that he went back to see if he could meet him again. You know, it's that level, not a false humility, not a false charm, but like really that level. Now, the story goes a bit further, because there were some of Murshid's very conservative students there that observed this moment of him acting in this way. And they said to him, Murshid, they kind of scolded him. Hidayat remembers this very well, walking down the street, and there were these students that had observed it. And they said, "Well, Murshid, you can't just go up and offer your hand to a man working in the street like that." And he turned to them and he said, "Are we not all the children of God?" And he turned and he just walked away. There are many stories like this. We have some of them recorded. We need to find them, their way into text, because not all of them are recorded. But, you know, lots of things where people were sent. When Murshid made this very strong split with the classical Sufism and went towards modern universal Sufism, there were people that didn't like that. Conservatives, you know, that's why he drew the line. And he said, "This is where I owe everything to my Chistia teacher, but the account has been paid in full, the account is closed, and now we make a new beginning." And he was followed and pursued. People tried to bring his life to an untimely end. But those very people often were the ones that became close in his students out of the respect of the way he would deal with those situations. He's a living example if we tune to him. And it's wonderful. I feel in a way this obligation to have these stories at one point transcribed and made into print, that we've had the beautiful opportunity to hear from Pir Murshid Hidayat. Every beautiful action, thought, or speech is derived from the effacing of self or ego. For instance, every manner of courtesy comes from holding the reins of the ego. Beauty of speech always depends on the same effacement of the self, and so it is with thought. As soon as the ego expresses itself without control, it hurts the ego of another person. The tendency in the lower creatures to fight is caused only by the ego, and man has this tendency no less than they, but rather more. It is this tendency which brings about disturbances in the life of individuals and in the multitude. The family feuds in ancient times and now wars all come from the same source, the ego. The idea of self-denial in Christianity, if rightly considered, expressed the idea of effacement rather than that of renunciation. You see, it's different. Those whose contact brings us comfort, ease, peace, always have a softened ego. The greater the person, the finer the ego. No example can be better than that of Christ washing the feet of his disciples. What builds man's ego is every kind of gratification of the ego. And what breaks the ego is patience and renunciation. The question whether it would be advisable to so destroy the ego that others might take advantage of a refined person is answered by saying that is not necessary that one should work against the ego, but one must control it. The question whether it would be advisable to so destroy the ego that others might take advantage of a refined person is answered by saying that it is not necessary that one should work against the ego, but one must control it. It would not be exaggerated if I said that man's worst enemy is his ego, his own ego. And when it is not under his control, man's thought, speech, and action are bent towards the gratification of his ego. And the more he satisfies his ego, the more his ego desires, and it is never satisfied. In Tibetan Buddhism, they have this realm, and in that cosmology, they consider it very real, but one also interprets that as states of consciousness, and they have a realm that's called the hungry ghost realm. It's kind of like that. You know, they're always hungry, they always want more, they're always making problems, you know. It's kind of like that. You know, are we hungry ghosts? Nobody else has such power in life of enslaving a man as his own ego. Man is, in fact, from the divine essence, and being so, he has the right to be king of his own life, which is his own kingdom or queendom. By the gratification of the ego, man falls from kingship into slavery. I think there are indications here, you know, if we're at all puzzled. Do we feel enslaved by our life circumstances, by our desires? Or do we feel free? And do we feel that we have some control over that? Someone may know who said this. I want to say it was Emerson, but I'm not sure. But there's a quote that says something like, and I'm paraphrasing, to feel like a wealthy person, one must lessen one's demands. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because, you know, there are all those beautiful stories about the wandering mendicant monks, and you know, when we had Umchuk Rinpoche visiting us some time ago, he was talking about, you know, the Tibetans as their one of the main staples of their diet is something that's called tsampa, and tsampa is roasted barley that's ground. And so it's very easy to carry in a bag when you're traveling for the nomads. And he said, you know, it's such a practical food when you think about it, and it's very environmental, he said. Mm-hmm. And he said, all you need is this, your bag of zampa, and if you travel with a little butter, it's okay. But if not, all you need is a little zampa, and even if you don't have water, you can just spit in your hand, you can put the there, and you can mix it up, and then it kind of, it turns into this kind of dough-like thing, and then they just eat it. And then he said, so you don't even really need a bowl. You know, you don't have to carry anything else. And he said, and then what happens is you eventually poop it out and it's good for the earth. You know, so he said it's very economical. Wait, but it's true. You know, it's like then you don't need the bowl and then you don't need something to wash the bowl and then you don't need someone to carry the bowl. And, you know, it's like it goes on and on, you know. So by the gratification of the ego, man falls into kingship. No, excuse me. By the gratification of the ego, man falls from kingship into slavery. And in the end, his own life becomes a burden to himself. And in order to gain his own kingdom, he must destroy the illusion that is satisfying his ego. He shows his power. He satisfies his enemy in satisfying his ego. So again, in order to gain his own kingdom, he must destroy the illusion that is satisfying his ego. And by doing so, he shows his power. A Persian poet says, each time that I make peace with my enemy, he has the opportunity of preparing again for the struggle. The great battle that the Sufis and sages and yogis fight is the battle with the ego. But the sage battles with his own ego, the ordinary man with other people's ego. That's the clue right there. That's it. Right there. But the sage battles with his own ego, the ordinary man with other people's egos. And the difference in the result of these two battles is that the victory and the failure of the ordinary man are momentary, but the victory of the sage is eternal. The former, when they have finished one battle, must begin another, but the latter, once he has succeeded, is victorious. All that the former gains, after all, is not his own, because his kingdom is not his own. All he gains does not belong to him, but the sage is king of his own kingdom. Sometimes these teachings can be quite challenging, and they go contrary to often what we're taught. I think that's why sometimes the holy ones are can be considered rather foolish, because living in this way is contrary to the world of competition, capitalism. I'm not saying those things aren't good, but what I'm saying is that when we are, you know, it's even become that way in the workplace, especially now. Companies are often using the bad economics of the time to pit one person against the other in competitive ways that are not helpful. They don't build camaraderie or cooperation amongst employees. They instill a kind of fear and competition. And anyway, we can consider this, you know, we can just consider this in our own manner.
Question from Alima. Alima, would you like to go ahead and turn your speaker on? Oh, she doesn't have.
Okay.
And it's Alima Petra.
Petra.
Petra. Has the ego always had to be destroyed, or is it also possible to befriend it and make it an inner guide in some way or another?
I don't think Merchant's saying we destroy it. I think he's saying to control it and to gain mastery over it. I mean, we kind of need the ego. You know, it there's that great story. I think it's the Mahabharata, where Hanuman, they call him the Monkey King. Do you all know this story? Mm-hmm. And you know, it's an indication to us, or a metaphor, that our animal nature can be brought into servitude to the divine. And in that story, Hanuman is such a great servant of Ram and Sita, and it teaches us this ability to train the ego to be flexible. So it's knowing when to act, knowing when to not act, knowing when to be big. Like Hanuman sometimes has to get really big because he's fighting that seven-headed monster, that huge monster, Ravana. So he has to get really big to protect the kingdom. And then at other times, in order to get into spaces, he has to get really tiny so he can get into some place where he needs to be. And there are other times where he has to be more humble and small, and there are other times where he has to be really big and strong to go get the mountain and fly with the sacred herb that helps, you know, overcome the poison. And so, but these are all also metaphors of how that if we soften the ego, then it's not like a rock upon rock. You know, when someone pushes against us, maybe we give a little bit. You know, we can flow a little bit. And we can know through mindful awareness when to act, when to not act. You know, if we see some harm being done in some way, it hopefully it's our natural instinct to protect. One could say that's the ego, but is it? Or is it just that part of us that, you know, part of our humanity is our egos too. And I think what's wonderful about these teachings, if we reflect in an open, inquisitive way on ourselves, not necessarily beating ourselves up, but we see, oh, when someone offends me, maybe my first inclination is to defend myself, you know, or, you know, someone, you know, maybe I just always want to have the last word somehow, you know, whatever those things are. Well, if we recognize them in ourselves, maybe we can say, okay, I'm going to just control that just a little bit. And then we can also see that maybe when someone else wants to have the last word with us, we understand it because we also do that. I mean, we can sympathize by self-examination how others do those things, because really it's a reflection. Don't like it, but it is often a reflection.
may have just said this, but I guess what I've been thinking about, you know, the practical implications for interaction with others. It seems that sometimes it's necessary to confront someone else,
mm-hmm.
and that even if that might trigger their egoistic reaction, I guess you hope it doesn't, because it's not, you know, that you don't want to put them in a corner where they have no room to move, because the intention is not to put them in a corner where nothing happens, but I guess I was wondering if the point is not to resort to those kind of confrontations just out of sort of unconscious egoistic desire of one's own, but to pick the moment.
Yeah, and not to try to control that other person, maybe. You know, it's amazing to me observing Pirmarsha Hadayat's interactions with people. I have seen the most difficult people. I am talking like you can't even imagine things that come out of these people's mouths and how they act. And, you know, he just kind of always looks at them very inquisitively, like, really? You know what I mean? And then he'll go, well, could it be understood this way? And then he kind of proposes another way, another perspective. He never says, your way's wrong, but, well, could it be like this? You know, and he is a very interesting way of dealing with people, especially extremely difficult people. And he does it again and again through just sort of suggesting alternatives. But I think he's learned a lot. I mean, you know, that's the beauty of being around people that have been on this earth a long time, you know, and in that search for awakening, because, you know, they've learned a lot along the way. And just to observe those interactions, and, you know, it's been, there have been times where I couldn't imagine enduring some of those things, and yet, you know, I know that he reflects on how to deal with these difficulties. Really constantly does that. You know, and we have it a little bit in our lives, but imagine we're in a big organization and managing all of that.
When you mentioned the example of Jesus washing his disciples' feet, what occurred to me was in the context of the culture that was actually a form of subtle confrontation, because it was shaking them up from their assumptions about how a master would teach a student, how one person would treat another person. So it was beautiful, but it was not. But it was also sort of unsettling, I think. I mean, who knows? But that's my understanding
of
what that story is about.
It's a possible interpretation.
Yeah.
Well, and it's also teaching through example. You know, that also that he was their teacher, and the idea that in the future they would be the teachers, and how perhaps not to set themselves up in a way, but to, you know, to teach with humility. I mean, it's a really interesting dynamic to have strength and humility at the same time, isn't it? Not false humility, mm-hmm. because believe me, that is the biggest play of the ego. Oh, I'm not this, I'm not that. Mm. That's all ego. That's a way of drawing people into your drama to get what you want from them. Some sort of feedback, you know. So there's two, you know, it's subtle. It's almost like it's really good just to be still and quiet. And observe oneself and others. Now, I'd like to just, we're coming upon 5 o'clock, and I know that people probably want to go to dinner and things like that. And before I forget, I do want us all to be mindful of, if, you know, just in terms of, we have our little donation basket out, and people that are online, if you'd like to contribute, all of this, none of this money stays here. This goes just through our hands elsewhere to help others and to help support the teachings and the, in all of its various ways. So we consider your generosity a gift, great gift. We consider your prayers also a great gift. So I have a student in India, and she wrote and she said, it's a very difficult life here, you know that, and I would like to give $10, and maybe the next time you come to India, I could give you $10. Because I've just sent a little letter around to some to students asking for them to consider, you know, tithing. And I said to her, you know what? Your greatest gift is if you could take a few little rupees and go to the temples and say prayers for us. You don't need to worry about your $10. That's also very helpful. So, but I thought, how sweet was that? You know, $10 is like, you know, almost a living for a month there, believe me. So, you know, when I sometimes think that I can figure things out, and then I remember that I can't. I can study, I can practice, but there is something beyond all of that thinking, which is also the ego, that wants to figure it out, that wants to get it right, that wants to manage things. And Joe and I were even talking about that. We had a guest last week, an American, but he's a Tibetan Buddhist monk and a wonderful human being. And we were talking about that. You know, what is our object of reliance? What is the object of reliance? For the Sufis, it's the divine, or it's the beloved. For others, that, you know, iconography, or that great being, maybe it's Jesus Christ, or maybe it's Buddha, or maybe it's Muhammad. Doesn't matter. They're really all one and the same being. It's that illuminated mind, presence. So I like to work with this breath that maybe can also be our friend through this next month. As these things arise and we question, is that a play of my ego? Or is this appropriate? Is this not appropriate? Is this wholesome? Is this unwholesome? Does this bring happiness? Does this bring unhappiness? To rely on the breath is very key, and to have that object of reliance. And so working with the same cycle of breath that we worked with before, there are different ways in which you could... was there something there?
Reliance.
Reliance. Is this from Alima? Okay. Help me. What would be the other... you can lean on it, or you can count on this, or dependence on. But dependent is like a different thing. This is like, Joe, help me. It's like refuge. Do you understand the meaning of refuge, Alima? What else? What are some other words? Sometimes I get stuck in my own vocabulary.
Trust,
yes.
Yes, she understands.
Okay, good. Thank you. And Alima, I want to thank you for your work you're doing in translating. She's working translating some of the prayers into Dutch. And so we've had some interesting dialogues about what does this word really mean? So there are the healing breaths that Murshid has given to us, and initially he intended that breath working with the phrase Yashafi, Yakafi, to be as part of the training for the people in the spiritual healing activity. It was not intended for a practice for everyone, but it is a very widespread practice. So I think it's wonderful that people are doing that, but to be mindful of the fact that that is part of the training for the healing activity. Now, one can work with the phrase, with the foreign language, Yashafi, Yakafi, or one can work with English. So really, I leave that to you. But an alternative might be to breathe in the phrase. I'll say it in a few ways. You'll feel what resonates with you. So one is breathing in Yashafi, out Yakafi. Shafi is sometimes spelled S-H-A-F-F-E-E or S-H-A-F-I. Coffee is K-H-A-F-F-E-E or sometimes you see it K-H-A-F-I. Shafi, coffee. Shafi is the divine aspect of the divine as the healer. And coffee is sometimes interpreted as the one, the divine attribute that is all sufficient, or one could say the divine remedy. So when you breathe in, you can breathe in Ya Shafi and out Ya Kafi, or you could use the phrase, you are my divine healer. You are my divine remedy. Or, thou art the divine healer. Thou art the divine remedy. But whatever one does, make the practice very personal. Feel that refuge, that reliance, that ability to lean into this aspect of the divine to help us heal those parts of ourselves that actually kind of become the crooked part of the ego. And to understand, like Hanuman, how to bring the ego into sort of the divine servant. So we will breathe in the nose and out the nose using the phrase Ya Shafi, Ya Kafi. Or you are my divine healer. You are my divine remedy. Thou art the divine healer. Thou art the divine remedy. In the nose and out the nose. And with each breath, all the various dimensions are healed and come into an equilibrium, a health and remedy. And when those difficulties arise over the next month, use it as your homeopathy. It's coming up, okay, I'm going to take the hair of the dog that bit me and I'm going to examine it. I'm not going to react to it, or maybe initially one does react to it, but then examine it. Use it as part of the training. Bring it all to the path. Thou art the divine healer. Thou art the divine remedy. And then we breathe in the nose and out the mouth while continuing the phrase on the inhalation and the exhalation. Use the phrase of your choice, the one that resonates most deeply and gives you that deep contact. in the nose and out the mouth. And now the breath changes and we breathe in the mouth and out the nose. Again, continuing with the phrase of your choice on that inhalation and exhalation. Yashafi, Yakafi. You are my divine healer. You are my divine remedy. Thou art the divine healer. Thou art the divine remedy. Now bring the breath in through the mouth and out through the mouth, while again continuing with the phrase. Now breathe in subtly, in and out the nose. some warm kind of spiced tea. It's not caffeinated, so be forewarned. If you need some caffeine, you may need to get some after here. And I've been informed, Amin Marty called just before class. He said it's cool in the church, so you may want to, you know, be mindful of that. Make sure you have extra clothing. He says it's probably about 60, but you know, once we all get there and start moving, we'll probably be okay. Yes, Mom.
I want to thank everybody here that prayed for me and gave me their time clocks. Because without it, I'm sure I wouldn't be walking. Very grateful.
Yeah, Mom, and I was thinking when we were breathing, you have a prayer, expect a miracle. Can you say that for us?
Expect a miracle every day. Expect a miracle when you pray. If you expect, God will find a way to perform a miracle for you each day.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I respect for all.
Thank you, Mom. Mm-hmm. And we have, as I said, some little treats in there. And we have books, so if anyone's still in need of a Christmas present for someone, we have those. And also, now here's my public service announcement. Some of you know about this, the Mysticism of Silence DVD of yours truly in Holland, giving a talk. And the interesting thing about this is that the person that recorded this, they do the recordings for the lectures and many of the activities at summer school there in Holland. And he's someone 30 years of experience in professional videography. Have I told you all this? So anyway, you know, and worked for TV and, you know, done all this. So, I mean, and this is his business. So, you know, he and his life partner, they both do it, and they have one that's like a direct feed from the microphone and then one that's just kind of panning the audience and things. That's a remote, or I don't know, is that what that's called? Or a built-in mic over on that camera. So he came to me the next day and he said, and he was real excited about the lecture, you know, the content of the lecture, the Mysticism of Silence. And he said, it's never happened. 30 years as a professional. I went and I put the reel on and it was completely silent. And I said, well, you know, that's a lecture on the Mysticism of Silence. I said, but you know, maybe you can do something wonderful with it. So what he's done is you can still hear the remote one and see that, and he's intermixed. It's much more interesting than just watching someone lecture, because when I'm talking about the cosmos, you see these beautiful pictures, and when I talk about nature, the birth of a baby, he's intermixed that. So it's like this beautiful project that he's created too, along with the lecture. So that might be something that some of you may be interested in. And we brought some, he made extras, and we brought some back from Europe this summer. So shall we rise and say a prayer together? Yes, please be careful of cords and plugs and things there. So let us say the prayer Khatun together. O
thou who art the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the Lord of heaven and earth, open our hearts that we may hear thy voice, which constantly cometh from within. Disclose to us thy divine light, which is hidden in our souls, that we may know and understand life better. Most merciful and compassionate God, give us thy great goodness, teach us thy loving forgiveness, raise us above the distinctions and differences which divide. Send us the peace of thy divine spirit, and unite us all in thy perfect being. Amen.